All right, let's lock up the Oregon Fuel Injection Hotline. Get the local view from our traditional Tuesday leadoff man doing his thing for the Register Guard. Catch his work on the cover of the sports section. Pick up a copy of the paper. RegisterGuard.com online. Follow on Twitter at AustinMeekRG. Austin, good afternoon. How you doing?
Hey, Steve. I'm doing all right. How are you?
All righty. So how was Father's Day? Was this number 3 or 4 for you?
Well, let's see. I guess this is number 3, and it was very nice. I spent some time with the kiddo. We got out and enjoyed the great outdoors, and I made it a whole day without doing any work, so that was a successful,
nice.
Successful Father's Day in my book.
It is. I did less. I golfed. That was my effort.
There you go.
I heard your interview with John Canzano, and I know you hit on a variety of subjects, but one that really struck me in the way too soon category, he asked, which game is most important year one under Willie Taggart? And I'll tell you the truth, I've seen 4 different answers. I won't give them away. What did you tell John and why?
Well, you know, I hadn't given it a lot of thought, and the first game that came to my mind was obviously the Civil War, which is important every year, but I think this year is going to be a whole different dynamic than at any point since I've been here with Willie Taggart coming in. It's a total unknown, and it seems like Gary Anderson's now maybe on the verge of turning the corner at Oregon State. So I'm curious if Oregon State winning that game last season is a sign of things to come. Or if Oregon under Willie Taggart will assert itself as still being the dominant program in the state. So that game's very interesting. But after I thought about it a little more, I guess maybe 1A and 1B here would be the Nebraska game because it comes early in the season before we'll really know a lot about the Ducks. And obviously losing to Mike Riley last year didn't sit very well with a lot of people and have a chance for payback with Nebraska coming in here. So I think that game could really set the tone for the season.
Yeah, those are my blue leaders, Nebraska, Civil War, and at Stanford. I know the Luke Heimlich story has been a powerhouse and generated passionate feelings on all sides. You wrote about an interesting angle on Friday. Pete Shannon, a former Duck football player who's a licensed counselor, works with sex offenders. And the question was how surviving victims feel when the abuser is placed, I think you said, in a position of prominence. Kind of interesting. What was his take on this very difficult issue? And I think he even mentioned how unlikely, although there's a possibility of reconciliation between the two.
Well, it is a difficult issue. I got a lot of response to the first Luke Heimlich column I wrote. I'm sure you got a lot of response from people on that issue as well. Really all over the map. But I did hear from a lot of folks who wanted to represent the viewpoint of people who commit crimes and are rehabilitated from those crimes, and maybe the difficulty for those people of being integrated back into society. Peter Shannon, the guy I talked to for the second column, he works with sex offenders. That's his specialty. He counsels them. He works to help them get back on their feet and be productive members of society. And he was representing the viewpoint, I think, that if you ostracize and stigmatize people who commit these crimes, then they're never going to get better. And it's in the interest of all of us in society for those people to get better. And so we talked about that, and you know, I think he was coming at it from one side of it, and maybe I was coming at it from the other side of it. And I think we agreed that there are some parts of this where there's just no good answer.
Right.
And one of those issues is what happens when the interests conflict. You know, if an individual who has committed this crime has been rehabilitated, is experiencing success in his life, and works his way into a position of prominence, how does that affect somebody who was the victim of the crime? And how do you balance the interests of the person who's the victim of the crime with the interest of helping the person who committed the crime to get better? Boy, that's,
yeah, it does.
I'm already way out of my depth here, so I'm going to stop talking. But it suffice it to say, it's a very complicated issue.
No, I thought it was an outstanding follow-up. And I actually saw some people in the comments section, which is usually like, actually, you know, rational and giving you credit for visiting the other side. So well done there.
And
folks, you could archive that, registerguard.com. Today's piece, Brent Primus, who happens to be a buddy of my son, fighting for the lightweight mixed martial arts title Saturday at the Garden in New York, Bellator 180. I've asked you this before, you know, not when you write about basketball or football, but when it's kind of an offbeat topic, kind of, what was the inspiration? How did you end up pursuing Brent as a topic for one of your columns?
Well, I think a member of his team had reached out to us to say, hey, this guy from Eugene is going to be fighting at Madison Square Garden in a couple weeks. And, you know, I can't claim to be a big MMA fan or an MMA fan at all. I can't claim to follow it very closely. But anytime you've got an athlete competing on the national stage like this, somebody from Eugene, he grew up here, he went to Sheldon High School. That's obviously a significant thing, and he's got a pretty compelling story. You know, with things like this, a lot of times what will get me interested is not so much just the event itself, but the backstory.
Sure.
And Brent has a really, really fascinating backstory.
Talking with Austin Mika, the Register Guard, his background is intriguing. For those who have not caught up, like you said, local guy, trains in Springfield growing up. What did you discover? Some trying circumstances from what happened with his dad, young single mom, and at a very young age, he had to live on his own.
Yeah, it's it's a story about a guy who grew up without a father in the house. His father was incarcerated when he was a kid. His mother remarried when he was a teenager. He butted heads with his stepfather and ended up living on his own when he was pretty young. Went down some dark paths. Got involved with selling drugs. And he says the thing that really saved his life was discovering jiu-jitsu. He became very accomplished in that, earned a black belt very quickly. From there, got into cage fighting and caught a break when Bellator signed him to a contract. And now he's going to fight for the world title. So it's kind of the stereotypical rags to riches story, but for this guy, just looking at what he's been through, it's pretty amazing to see him come out the other side.
Yeah, and now he's going to be a dad real soon, which is kind of an awesome tag to that story. Austin, at this time of year, let's get to something a little lighter. Athlon just released their top 50 college football players of the last 50 years. In essence, it kind of looks like it started with the O.J. Simpson era all the way up to, Marcus Mariota's on the list. Their top five was Herschel Walker, Barry Sanders, Archie Griffin, Earl Campbell, Bo Jackson. You've covered the game for a while. Who would be the two or three guys that you've seen in person that you'd be like, yeah, if they asked me to make this list, I'd probably start there?
Well, I didn't see any of those top five guys in their prime, I don't think.
No.
I did see the one guy on the list who I did cover, obviously, is Marcus Mariota, and that's probably unless somebody knocks him off, that's going to be my go-to answer as the best college football player I've ever covered. And it's going to take something pretty special for somebody to knock him out of that spot. Beyond that, a couple guys I covered. I covered Jordy Nelson when he was in college.
Oh, wow.
Obviously gone on to productive NFL career. And I covered Darren Sproles and watched Darren Sproles when I was younger.
Yeah, K-State, stud.
Yeah, he's an amazing college player and has had a really long and productive NFL career, even though he's about 5'6". He's the smallest guy in the room, but has had a great NFL career. So there's a couple guys who were very good college players and have gone on to be very good pros, too.
No, that's a good one. All during spring, many of us put up the no-sale sign that anybody but Justin Herbert was going to be the Oregon quarterback. The word was Travis Johnson was pushing him. It was great coach talk, but he's gone. So they've got Taylor Alley and a true freshman, Burmeister, on the roster. How concerning is this?
Well, it definitely puts more importance on Justin Herbert staying healthy. You almost could end up back in that situation again they had a couple years ago when Vernon Adams went down, and you realize, oh boy, they're pretty thin behind the starter. That could be the situation again this year. It's sort of what we talked about when Terry Wilson transferred, that it's just hard to convince a guy to stick around and be a backup anymore. Everybody wants to start, and everybody can read the writing on the wall. And I don't doubt that part of Willie Taggart's thinking in keeping the quarterback competition open is that you want to keep your quarterbacks engaged. You don't want to send the message early on that, you know, we've got one guy and the other guys are strictly backups, because this is what could happen. You could end up really thin on quarterback depth. So, we'll see what Braxton Burmeister can do. I'm sure in Oregon's perfect world, he would probably redshirt, but I don't know if he can do that anymore because basically after Justin Herbert, it's going to get real dicey.
It's a matter of all those offensive linemen. No pressure, guys, but you better keep this kid upright.
Yeah, really.
Let's wrap with this. The NBA draft is Thursday. As a Knicks fan, I'm trying to block it out. Oregon has, I would call it a sort of a quartet in the mix, something that we've really never seen here with Jordan Bell, Dylan Brooks, Tyler Dorsey, and maybe Chris Boucher. What's realistic here? You think it's Bell and Brooks hear their names and the other two get a free agent shot or a mix and match or something else?
Yeah, I think if three out of those four guys get drafted, that'll be a great night for Oregon. I obviously Jordan Bell is going to get drafted. I think there's a pretty good chance that he gets drafted in the first round. I expect him to be the highest of the Oregon draft picks. And Dylan Brooks and Tyler Dorsey, it's going to just kind of depend on if there's a team out there that they work out for, a team that likes them, that wants to take a shot with them in the second round. I could see either of them getting drafted. I could see either of them catching on as free agents. And, you know, Chris Boucher, it's hard to see him getting drafted coming off the injury. If he hadn't gotten hurt, I think he'd have a shot to get drafted. So he's probably looking at get healthy, come back, and see if somebody will take a shot on you. But, boy, if they could get three guys drafted on Thursday, that'd be a really good night for Oregon.
Yeah, especially with the exodus since the season ended.
Something to make people feel better.
Right. He is Austin Meek of the Register Guard, at Austin Meek RG on Twitter. Grab a copy of the paper, archive it online, registerguard.com. Justin, well, you're not Justin, Austin. Whoa, always a
close
pleasure. Yeah, I'm thinking about my old partner here. I guess I'm yearning. Have a good one. We'll catch up soon.
All right, see you.
All right.